Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. This is your host, Mike Polignano. In the first half of our podcast today, Countercurrents editor, Greg Johnson, reads his controversial essay, Money for Nothing. In the second half, we will hear Kevin McDonald's contribution to the Countercurrents Symposium on the Jewish Question Today, recorded in the summer 2011.
Everybody knows you need to work for your money. And if someone just gives you money, that can only be by the expropriation of somebody else's labor. Money just doesn't grow on trees, after all. But is this really true? Just because you worked for your money, did the guy who paid you also work for it? What about the guy who paid him? If you follow the money trail long enough, you're going to find someone who did not work for his money. He simply got it for nothing. He did not even have to go through the trouble of picking it off trees. He just created it out of thin air by bookkeeping. We call this man a banker. Unlike people who have to produce things of real value before they count them up and enter the number in a book, the banker creates his product simply by bookkeeping operations. The whole panoply of bank services, checking accounts, savings accounts, free toasters, checks with little baby ducklings and cute golden retrievers printed on them, these are all arguably props to disguise the fact that the core of banking is the sheer creation of money out of nothing. When I was a boy, one of the banks in my hometown gave out free piggy banks to children. Today, that seems like a masterstroke of propaganda, fostering the impression that real banks, just like piggy banks, can only give out money that they take in. But banks are not required to keep your deposits on hand. They loan them out. Every dollar in your checking or savings account is loaned out 10 times over. This is how bankers simply create money through bookkeeping. And that is just the beginning of how bankers create money. And bankers can do it even if they do not operate in buildings with Grecian columns out front and teller windows inside, even if they do not have checking and savings accounts and all the other props we associate with banking. But even though the money you borrow was created for nothing, you still have to pay it back, with interest. And when you do pay it back, you can't just create the money. You have to work for it. You have to provide real goods and services. Thus, bankers, by loaning out the money they create for nothing, gain a mortgage on future production of real-world goods and services. What is money, anyway? Money is a medium of exchange that allows one to convert the fruits of one's labor into easily portable tokens that one can exchange for the fruits of other people's labor. What one chooses for tokens does not really matter. Money can be bits of shiny metal, colorful slips of paper, electronic data in computers, or cowrie shells, just as long as they are accepted by the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. Money does not need to have any intrinsic value. In fact, it helps if its intrinsic value is next to nothing. Otherwise, people will hoard it rather than circulate it freely, which would cause an economic hardship known as deflation, in which money is a commodity whose value rises because its supply diminishes. When money is a commodity whose supply rises and its value decreases, that is called inflation. It's worth asking, can one avoid both evils, inflation and deflation? If money has no value in itself, that is to say, if it's not a commodity that can be bought and sold alongside bricks and butter. If the best money has no intrinsic value, then the worst sort of money would be precious metals. The best sort of money would be entirely intangible, just data in a computer. Even paper money can be hoarded, after all. For instance, if the price of toilet paper gets too high. Perhaps the best way to ensure that money is not hoarded at all is simply to print an expiration date on it. Ideally, money should be a self-effacing servant of the real economy, which produces actual goods and services. But money has grown into a jealous tyrant that interferes with the real economy. The simplest example is your average economic crisis. In an economic depression, the land does not suddenly go sterile. The udders of cows do not go dry. Men do not suddenly become stupid and lazy. The sun keeps shining, the crops keep growing, the chickens keep laying, people keep working, goods pile up in warehouses and stores, and on the demand side, people still need to eat. But silos are bursting and people are starving because, for some mysterious reason, there is suddenly not enough money. People have no money to spend, or they're afraid to part with the money they do have because of a climate of uncertainty. After all, halfway around the world, a massive swindle has been discovered, or a bank has collapsed, or a speculative bubble has burst. So naturally, back in Hooterville, stores are filled with sour milk and rotting vegetables, and children are going to bed hungry. If an able-bodied man were shipwrecked on a fertile island, he would not starve for lack of money. But on this vast and fertile island we call Earth, people starve amidst plenty because we have accepted the dominion of a monetary economy that disrupts the real economy. That is no way to run a planet. The obvious solution is simply to increase the money supply. One must make consumer demand effective so that the market clears and life can go on. And the simplest way to do that is for the government to print money and give it to people. Remember George W. Bush's 2008 stimulus checks? That was money for nothing, handed to people to stimulate economic activity. The effect, of course, was negligible, but it was morally and economically far preferable to the massive bailouts and the Obama stimulus plan that followed. Whereas the Bush stimulus checks went directly to millions of consumers, who injected the money directly into the economy when they purchased goods and services, the bailouts and stimulus spending went to a relative handful of politically connected insiders. It turns out, furthermore, that very little of the money went to stimulate the U.S. economy. Instead, a lot of it was invested overseas. Other recipients of bailouts held onto their cash, hoping that they could buy up real assets for cheap if the economy continued to slide deeper into depression. Moreover, whatever money did go into the U.S. economy came with strings attached, the necessity to repay principal and interest. At least with the Bush stimulus checks, the money went directly into the economy with no strings attached in straight-up purchases of goods and services. But, as we have seen, money for nothing is not merely part of an occasional emergency stimulus measure. It is business as usual for banks. But if money is being created out of nothing all the time, then we have to ask, should this be left to the banks, or is there a better way of doing it? Why not simply have the government create money and send each individual a monthly check to be spent as he sees fit? This money would stimulate the economy directly through the purchases of goods and services, whereas money created by banks in the form of loans must be paid back with interest, creating a parasitic class of people who get a share of real production by loaning out at interest a commodity that they get for nothing. Again, every industry that produces real goods and services has accounting and inventory costs, but actual production has to come first. You have to make toys before you can count them. With banks, however, money is created simply by bookkeeping operations, that is to say, making loans. Bankers produce merely by juggling numbers. But if money for nothing is simply a feature of the modern economy, why not cut out the parasitic, quote-unquote, private sector middlemen and simply have the government create money and distribute it directly to consumers? Why is the government preferable to the private sector as a creator of money? Because, unlike private businesses, the government is accountable to the public, in theory at least. Its purpose is to secure the common good. Moreover, when the private financial sector is in crisis, the bankers look to the government to bail them out anyway, at the expense of the taxpayers. Isn't it time for the government to bail the people out, at the expense of the banks? Let's repudiate all our debts and start fresh with a new financial system. But simply creating money and mailing out checks would be inflationary, some might object. True, but it would be no more inflationary than allowing banks to create money. Furthermore, there is a deeper issue here. Is inflation or deflation simply a product of the commodification of money? The commodification of money means that money is not merely a tool of exchange, but a commodity that is exchanged, a commodity with a cost of its own, interest. Would it be possible to decommodify money, that is to say, to eliminate interest and a secondary market in money, either partially or altogether? Would the creation of money that expires after a while cut down on the commodification of money? But money for nothing would be socialism, others would object. Yes, I am proposing socializing the creation and initial distribution of money. But what people do with the money at that point is their own business. The system I propose is completely consistent with private property and private enterprise. Indeed, it would strengthen and secure them because it would eliminate a parasitic class of people who steadily mulked the real economy and occasionally send it into crises by creating and loaning out money that is free to them and should be free to all. But how would businesses capitalize themselves without bank loans? That's a fair question. Perhaps the best answer is to say that just as individual consumers could get money for nothing from the state, so could creditable producers. But nothing about my proposal would prevent banks and credit unions from forming to capitalize businesses. But they would not be allowed to create money out of thin air. They would have to attract savings by paying interest, then loan out their deposits, and no more than their deposits, add interest to creditworthy businessmen. To do this, banks would have to offer serious interest for savings and charge serious interest on loans. But it could be done. It would definitely be tight money, though, which might be a good thing in the long run, since it would discourage speculative investments. Of course, if money went bad after a while, it would make no sense to save it. But none of this might be necessary if interest-free state financing is a viable option, and it is certainly a question worth exploring. Nothing, moreover, would prevent businesses from capitalizing themselves by selling shares and paying dividends. But shouldn't people work for their money? Yes and no. Money needs to get into circulation, and the modern welfare state gives people money for nothing all the time in the form of unemployment insurance, old age pensions, welfare payments, food aid, health care, and so forth. Why not bundle all these benefits together into a single flat monthly payment? These payments could be enough to ensure the basic social safety net that we all have anyway. It would also be fairer than the present system, which expropriates the fruits of some people's labor to redistribute them to others. It would, in effect, be welfare without redistribution. But the basic payments I envision would not allow people to live opulently. Thus, most people would choose to work. Some might choose to invest their monthly checks. Others might wish to defer them so that they can enjoy better old age pensions. But the whole character of work would be changed, because people would not work because they have to, they would work because they want to. The socialist dream of the, quote, decommodification of labor would be realized. Sure, some people might choose to spend their time smoking dope and strumming guitars, but one of them might be the next Goethe or Wagner, and certainly we would be better off extending the adolescences of a million bohemians, like the people at the Occupy encampments, for instance, than supporting 1,000 scheming Wolfowitzes, Madoffs, and Shylocks, along with their warmonger and pornmonger cousins. But this system would create public debt, some might object. But I'm talking about creating money, not borrowing it. Why should the government allow banks to create money and then loan it at interest to the government when the government can create money itself? The very existence of public debt goes back to the time when money was something of intrinsic value, like gold, that banks might possess and that the government could not just make up. A government that can simply create money has no need of public debt. But this system will create idleness, is another objection. Yes, but there is nothing wrong with idleness. In fact, as I see it, the whole point of social and technological progress is to create a world in which machines put us all out of work. The goal of social policy should be to create conditions of ever-increasing productivity through scientific and technological progress. But it would be ecologically irresponsible, indeed catastrophic, if people were to take the gains of increased productivity in the form of more consumer goods or burgeoning population growth. Thus, the goal of social policy should be to keep consumption roughly stable and cash out productivity gains in terms of ever shorter work weeks. As productivity increases, it might be possible to maintain a comfortable standard of living with 20 hours of work per week, then 10, then 5, then 1. Or, in industries where full-time work is necessary, it might be possible to work 40 hours a week for 10 years and then simply retire. When the work week approaches 0 hours, we would be living in a Star Trek economy in which scarcity of physical goods is abolished through the invention of unlimited cheap and clean energy sources and the replicator, which can turn energy into any desired good, simply poofing it into existence. In such a world, the only scarcity would be ecological carrying capacity, which would have to be zealously guarded by keeping populations in check or sending them out to colonize the stars, terraform dead planets, create galactic empires, and so forth. But what would people do with their leisure? Such a society would be the culmination, and I would argue, following Hegel, the hidden inner purpose of all human striving from the moment man first differentiated himself from the animals and stepped into history. It would obviously be a farce if mankind struggled for millennia only to give birth to a world of indolent, empowered morons. Imagine Homer Simpson poofing donuts and Duff into existence while watching hollow porn until he becomes one of the boneless blobs in hover chairs depicted in WALL-E. Utopia would be wasted on such people. Thus, along with scientific, technological, and social progress, we would also need to pursue cultural, spiritual, and genetic progress to create a race worthy of utopia. A job is just something you do to make money so you can do the things you really enjoy. A job is just a means of doing things that are ends in themselves. Once machines put us out of work and the lollygaggers and lotus eaters are bred out of the gene pool, people can busy themselves doing the things they find intrinsically rewarding. Raising children, writing books, playing and composing music, writing software, inventing machines, playing sports, tending gardens, perfecting recipes, advancing science, fighting for justice, exploring the cosmos, and so forth. It will be a realm of freedom in which the human potential to create beauty, do good, and experience joy will be unhampered by economic necessity. This is the stuff of science fiction and other utopias, staples of the American imagination. Yet the dominant political paradigm in America and the rest of the white world is profoundly regressive and dysgenic. While whites dream of the space age, our system is headed towards the Stone Age, worshipping Negroes as heroes and gods. Morgan Freeman has been typecast as God, and placing the product of dysgenic miscegenation in the highest office of the land. If we are to resume the path to the stars, we will have to begin by addressing four principal evils: dysgenics, economic globalization, racial diversity, including non-white immigration, and finance capitalism. What do we call this alternative economic paradigm? Ultimately, I would call it National Socialism. But the little anthology of economic heresies I have assembled above is drawn primarily from the social credit ideas of Clifford Hugh Douglas and Alfred Richard Orridge, partly by way of Alan Watts, who was my first introduction to these ideas, and Ezra Pound, who is the most famous exponent of social credit. It is my conviction that the North American New Right, if it is to provide a genuine alternative to the existing system, must break with all forms of free market economic orthodoxy and work to recover and develop the rich array of third-way economic theories, including social credit, distributism, guild socialism, corporatism, and populism. This essay and others, including ones to come, are my naive attempts to start a conversation in the hope that it might draw in other writers who are more qualified to construct a critique of capitalist orthodoxy. Creating an ideal world will cost us, and our enemies, a great deal in real terms. But the first step toward freedom, namely the act of imagining it, is free.
Money for Nothing was published January 17, 2012, online at Countercurrents North American New Right, which is www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.
Our musical break today is one of Edward Elgar's Enigma variations. This is the ninth variation, which is called Nimrod. Nimrod is the name of the mythical mighty hunter in the book of Genesis. Elgar chose this name because the variation is a musical portrait of his friend, music publisher Augustus Jaeger, and Jaeger's name in German means hunter. I don't know anything about Augustus Jaeger, but listening to this music leads me to conclude that he must have been a very noble individual.
In the summer of 2011, Professor Kevin MacDonald spoke to a countercurrents gathering on the Jewish question today. These are his remarks.
Thank you. I thought what I'd do, talking about what the Jewish question is right now, I wrote a preface to the paper that I guess in the Culture Critique in 2002, and basically I went through, you know, a lot of different aspects of the Jewish question. I think it's a complicated, multifaceted kind of thing. I thought I'd just sort of update what's happening, how has Jewish power influence changed, how have things changed in the last 10 years, if anything. And the first thing I talked about was Jewish domination of the media, talking about what percentage companies and people who are creating content and so on are Jewish. That hasn't changed. And so we still see a huge percentage of you know, anti-Christian messages, anti-white message, anti-stereotypical messages about blacks and Mexicans and so on. So certainly there hasn't been any positive change in the last 10 years as far as the media goes. The other issue I talked about related to that is Jewish organizations were taking a very large role in trying to censor the Internet, seeing the Internet as the way of the future. And certainly we've talked today, you know, the Internet publication, it's really the most, I think, probably the biggest weapon that we have these days. I was saying in this area that Jewish organizations have not really gotten what they want. I mean, they would really, the First Amendment is a major barrier to them. If you look in other countries of the world, Australia, Europe, and so on, Jewish organizations routinely support laws against free speech, Holocaust denial laws, but all kinds of other hate crime laws and so on. They've not really been able to do that in America, although recent hate crime law in Congress was pushed by the ADL, it was begun by them. So they are trying, you know, certainly to go in that direction, but I think we have a very strong Supreme Court at this point, but it's a 5-4 majority. If Obama gets another appointment, I'm not sure at all that would hold. The other thing I talked about was the rise of the political right in Israel. In Israel now, you've got probably the most racialist right-wing government in its history, as Mark was talking about. You have apartheid, you have ethnic cleansing, you have all these laws that discriminate against the Palestinians. You have fundamentalists and settler groups, which are they're very mainstream. They're not at all fringe elements in Israeli society. They're very much a political power. They are actually the power behind the present situation within Israel. We also talked about the power of the Israel lobby in the United States, as Mark was also mentioning. Since 2002, we've had especially the book by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Wolf. I think that was a very major event. But still, at the same time, we still have the war in Iraq. We've got huge pressure now for some kind of dealing with Iran. As Mark was saying, when Benjamin Netanyahu came to America, he had these 30 standing ovations. Just this summer, 81 members of Congress went on junkets to Israel, paid for by Jewish activist organizations. So, Israel, the Congress is still very much Israel-occupied territory, you might say. I don't think that has changed. We also talked about the ADL as a sort of policeman organization. That it was actually discussed as how they were favoring these open immigration laws. They were congratulating Germany because they got rid of biological descent as far as immigration, and they thought that was just wonderful. Of course, with Israel, it's very different. But there's no question that the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center, since 2002, it's become very clear that the Southern Poverty Law Center, if it wasn't clear before, is a sort of de facto Jewish organization. If you look at where the money comes from, who the main officers are, and so on, and its policies and so on, which certainly are very similar to the sort of mainstream policies of the Jewish community, it really is a Jewish activist organization. These organizations are very well funded, approximately $30 to $50 million per year going in there. Several articles on VDare talking about the huge slush fund that the Southern Poverty Law Center has, it's $200 million now or whatever. They are extremely well funded, and all that money is being used against us. And when you think the trivial amounts of money that are really being channeled towards white causes, this is one of our biggest problems. The anti-white movements are funded just lavishly, whereas we are scrapping. And of course, the fact is that right now things are sort of on autopilot. It's not like they're really worried about anything. If things really got bad, you would see huge amounts of money pouring in to organizations like the SPLC, the ADL, and other organizations of the left. The other thing that was talked about is the role of Jews in communism, that this has been sort of papered over. Certainly, Jews were the backbone of the left in the 20th century, had a huge role in communism in the Soviet Union. That's pretty much been papered over. Since I wrote that in 2002, you've had books by Sleskind on the role of Jews in the Soviet Union, and you've had Alexander Solzhenitsyn's book, 200 Years Together, both excellent books. They extend this, they provide an even firmer foundation for the idea that Jews played a prominent, a really critical role in the Soviet Union, at least up until the end of World War II. And yet, again, that kind of thinking has not really penetrated into the popular consciousness. You don't see academics talking that way. It is not in the media. And again, that's one of the roles of the ADL and the SPLC, is to absolutely, very rigorously police the media. These are the policemen out there. They are very closely integrated with the police departments, with the FBI, with all levels of the federal government. This is a very major source of Jewish power in America now. I also talked about the culture of the Holocaust as being pervasive, as being pervasive in the school system, pervasive in the media. You know, there's so many movies now that have been made with those themes. Every year, virtually, we have them. The Holocaust has thus become an instrument of Jewish ethnic interest, not only as a symbol intended to create moral revulsion at violence against ethnic groups, prototypically the Jews, but also as an instrument to silence opponents of high levels of non-white immigration into Western countries. It's been institutionalized as an American icon. This is entirely the result of Jewish influence on culture and the media and the academic world. I also talked about one issue that is pretty new, is the idea that In Europe, we've seen the rise of these nationalist parties. I think this is a very, very encouraging sign. I think if the revolution comes, and I think it will come eventually, I think it's going to start in Europe. We see now the rise of parties that are explicitly anti-Muslim. They're certainly not talking in racialist terms. But these parties have tried to make alliances with pro-Israel politicians and so on. They are, at least most of them are, very strongly philo-Semitic. Geert Wilders is a paradigm in that regard. He's been to Israel a number of times. He's very pro-Israel, yet he's, anti-immigration. So far, it does seem as if certainly that's been condemned by the organized Jewish community. The organized Jewish community is not going for the idea that just supporting Israel is enough. They're basically want to have their cake and eat it too. That is, they want to have high levels of immigration, even if that includes some Muslims. They certainly within this country they want a sort of housebroken Islam, right? They want an Islam that won't be too concerned about what's going on in Israel. They won't be terrorists and all that. But they are moving ahead in that direction. The organized Jewish community is not supporting his parties in Europe that are against Muslim immigration at all. And I think only about 2% of Jews are doing this. But this is definitely a new issue. And there are some politicians in Israel that have gone for this, that have, because they see Israel being more and more isolated. Israel, you've got the so-called BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanction movement now, which is getting pretty effective. Israel, I think, does feel more under threat than ever before. They feel they are isolated. Certainly, it's very common in Europe. And actually, one of the aspects of the slaughter in Oslo was the fact that party there that was being attacked was very left-wing. They were very anti-Israel. So this is pretty common. It's pretty mainstream in Europe to be anti-Israel. They can see the ethnic cleansing. They can see the apartheid. And as honest leftists, it bothers them. Now, of course, that's different from us. I mean, we're honest rightists, and we want our own nationalism. But at the same time, that is one of the, I think, important new trends. I guess that's what the main way that I see what the Jewish question is today. I would say that in general, and this is the way I concluded that, this is 2002 and I think it's still true today, said the present Judaized cultural imperium in the West is maintained by pervasive thought control propagated by the mass media and extending to self-censorship by academics, politicians, and others well aware of the dire personal and professional consequences of crossing the boundaries of acceptable thought and behavior. It's maintained by zealously promulgated, self-serving, essentially false theories of the history and nature of Judaism and the history and causes of anti-Semitism. The fact is that Jewish populations have always had tremendous influences on the society that they have lived among. In the 15th century, if you were in Spain, that was the most important issue. You know, these Jews that had supposedly converted to Christianity, they rose to the highest levels of society, they were dominating everything, and you had anti-Semitism, and certainly in Europe, and in the 20th century, and certainly in the late 19th century, Jewish rise to prominence in commerce, in the media, in industry, and everything else. Huge, impact and causing tensions in those societies. Nothing has changed there. So my perception is that the organized Jewish community is moving aggressively ahead. The word aggressive. I think that the typical stance of especially Eastern European Jews, and Paul Gottfried, among others, has this thing between Eastern and Western European Jews. I think that, you can overemphasize that, but the reality is that Eastern European Jews seem to be more aggressive, more hostile towards the traditional people and cultures of the world, especially the United States and Europe, and concerned about the history of anti-Semitism and so on. And Jews are certainly at the top rung of our society, as Mark was saying. There is no more powerful group that we can single out ethnically in any other way. Jews, approximately, when I wrote the thing, I noticed I said that the Jews were 25% of the Forbes list of wealthiest Americans. Well, now it's more like 37%. This is 10 years later. If you're on that list, you've got to have at least $1 billion around there. So think about it. You've got probably close to $800 billion just among those 137 Jews, or 37% of 400. It's an enormous amount of money that, again, when push comes to shove, would be used against our interests. So this is a very formidable enemy. The Jewish question is with us, and anybody who's not really thinking those sort of things, you don't have to talk about it, but if you're not realizing it, this is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. When you're talking about immigration, when you're talking about multiculturalism, when you're talking about American foreign policy and the whole thing, this is pretty much the group that you can't offend. And their interests are not at all the same as ours. Thank you.
During the question and answer session, one questioner asked the following. Question: what are we doing wrong? I'm looking at Muslim countries, especially Iran, the most obvious example, that have had Jewish minorities living there for centuries, like in Tehran, and yet they don't run the country. How do they manage that?
Yeah, that's an interesting historical or cultural question. The reality is that Jewish groups were pretty much kept down in Muslim countries. There's a sort of mythology that Jews and Muslims got along well in this multicultural paradise, but the reality, simply not the case. And especially as history ground on towards the 20th century, Jewish populations were very much oppressed in the Muslim world. And there was no fear of Jews. There was no hatred, really. It was just like they were to be kept out. And they did a very good job. Now, the problem in Europe, of course, has been the Enlightenment and the relative lack of ethnocentrism, universalism, and all these ideals that prevented that. If you go to the Middle Ages, there were certainly times and places. Jews had to wear special clothing. They had to be in a certain ghetto. They restricted them from certain things. But you stop seeing that with the Enlightenment. And then Jews just coming out, emancipation, rising to the top economically, and the cultural positions, the academic world, and so on. That's been the problem.
So as a follow-up, I'm assuming you're saying that they keep them out of the professions where they could acquire power?
Yeah, they had very clear group boundaries, and they were enforced. And as I say, that has happened in Western societies, sometimes in places. But since the Enlightenment, it's been spottier and spottier. And certainly now, you know, if you were to suggest that, it would, you know, transgress against all enlightened ideas, right? Can't do that.
My question is kind of twofold. I've seen increasingly in the past few years a growing number of Jews who are anti-Zionist, Jewish groups who are, you know, willing to speak out against the Israel lobby. I think Mearsheim and Revolt were, you know, the beginning of that. And I know that there's a group called J Street, which is opposing AIPAC and wants to replace AIPAC. And I'd like to know your thoughts on that. The second part of my question is regarding ethno-nationalism. It seems to me that in the end there are two answers to the Jewish question. One is Theodore Herzl's answer, which is all the Jews go back to Israel and they have their own state. They could continue to exist as a diaspora in white countries. There always is going to be a conflict because they support their own interests. And the only other way that we can win, aside from sending Jews back to Israel, is for something to happen like what happened in World War II. I've been asking myself, should white nationalists support Zionism to some extent if we can get all the Jews to agree to go back to Israel?
Yeah, I actually
also
proposed that and actually angered a lot of people. But the idea was if you could really get the organized Jewish community behind an anti-immigration thing, you know, and in return we would support Israel to the hilt, you know, I'd go for that deal. The main thing is getting rid of immigration. The first one, it is true that there have been some sort of high-profile articles by David Brooks, I think was one, talking about the fact that the young Jews are disaffected from Israel and so on, disconnected, less gung-ho. And now within Israel, there's a lot of malaise in Israel economically. People are having a hard time making ends meet. There's a lot of difficulties there. But again, I don't think it's really affected the source of Jewish power. Like, AIPAC is still AIPAC. J Street is still a marginal player at best. And they are not really anti-Israel. They want a sort of, they certainly are, you know, softer line on Israel, but it's not anything, it's not, they're still Zionist, and they want I think they want a two-state solution. But it's not, they're not, and then they're, you know, critical of the settler movement and so on. But if you look at the Jewish community in general, you know, when Netanyahu came over and there was a big kerfuffle with Obama, they were at odds with each other. You know, it got papered over pretty fast, and it hasn't really changed fundamental U.S. policy. So a lot of this is sort of smoke without really showing any difference, I don't think, in the basic reality of Jewish power, which is, again, firmly behind AIPAC, and AIPAC is firmly behind the right wing in Israel. They are pro-settler and basically supporting Israel to the hilt.
Our second musical break is a preview of an upcoming show which we are going to devote to the music of Lewis Hardin, also known as Moondog. This is a piece called Elf Dance, and it is performed on harp by Xenia Nerati. Again, the music of Moondog. This is Elf Dance. Thank you.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.